Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from the petitioner in Johnson & Higgins versus Kinnico Energy. This lawsuit arose from a dispute between an oil trading company and an insurance broker concerning coverage of a valuable cargo of fuel oil under a marine insurance policy. Johnson & Higgins filed the action in 1988 after Kinnico had asserted a claim that it had been damaged by misrepresentations concerning coverage that allegedly had been made at a meeting that occurred on November 30, 1982. Johnson & Higgins sought a declaration from the court that Kinnico was barred by the doctrines of collateral estoppel and res judicata from asserting its claims because a federal court in New York, in an earlier suit filed by Kinnico against its insurance carriers, had made factual findings adverse to Kinnico concerning what happened at the November 30 meeting, and those findings had been affirmed by the Second Circuit. At the conclusion of discovery, Johnson & Higgins moved for summary judgment. That motion was denied, and the case proceeded to trial. The jury found against Johnson & Higgins on four theories of liability and awarded $1.9 million in actual damages. Judge Lamar McCorkle, however, granted judgment in favor of Johnson & Higgins, notwithstanding the verdict, presumably on the basis of Johnson & Higgins' collateral estoppel and res judicata theories. Kinnico appealed, and the First Court of Appeals reversed. The Court of Appeals reinstated the jury's verdict, and also purporting to follow this court's decision in Kavanaugh versus Quality Parking, awarded prejudgment interest from September 1983 in the amount of $2.7 million. This court granted our writ application on four of our 6 points of error. I propose to use my time during oral argument to discuss the first point, which concerns collateral estoppel, and the fifth and sixth points, which concern prejudgment interest, and to leave the other points to the briefs unless the court has specific questions. The relief Johnson Higgins seeks here is to have the decision of the Court of Appeals reversed and a take-nothing judgment rendered in favor of Johnson & Higgins.
With regard to the collateral estoppel issue, have you seen this sheet?
I have seen that sheet.
What's your answer to that?
My answer to that is that that all these blanks are that the blanks with regard to issues 1, 7, 13, 17, and 21 can all be filled in with specific findings made by Judge Grisa in the federal court and affirmed by the Second Circuit.
Would you say that again? You say with the exception of what?
The liability issues on this chart, which are issues 1, 7, 13, 17, and 21, specific factual findings were made by the federal court with regard to each of the facts underlying those particular jury issues.
Which specific findings go to the negligence cause of action?
The only evidence of negligence in the case relates to statements allegedly made by Mr. Anderson to Ms. Brown at the November 30 meeting. The specific negligence question, question 21, inquired about whether ordinary care was exercised at the November 30 meeting. And the specific findings made by Judge Grisa, affirmed by the Second Circuit, with regard to the statements that Mr. Anderson made or did not make to Ms. Anderson go directly to the negligence questions.
At the federal trial, wouldn't there have been some reason for Kinnico to not antagonize Johnson & Higgins because they were hoping to have some at least decent testimony from them? In other words, and that would tend to mean that they did not as vigorously cross-examine the witnesses as they might have?
Johnson & Higgins provided a witness to support Kinnico's theory at the federal trial on the damages question. That witness, whose name was Tom Riley, testified favorably to Kinnico's position with regard to damages. However, with regard to the events of the November 30, 1982 meeting, which was one of Kinnico's alternative theories of recovery, Kinnico necessarily had to and did take the position that misrepresentations had been made by Johnson & Higgins. Perhaps there might have been some incentive, theoretically at least, not to cross-examine as vigorously, but the fact that Kenneco made the choice to pursue that claim, to assert misrepresentation with regard to Mr. Anderson's statements, and the fact that Judge Grisa found that there had been no misrepresentation, basically leaves Kenneco with the choice that it made to try the case the way it wanted to try it. Judge Grisa specifically inquired, listening to the way the evidence was coming in at the federal trial, why Johnson Higgins was not a defendant. And so I think from the record, the court can conclude that there was a full and fair litigation of those issues before the federal court.
On the negligence claim, assuming that we were to conclude that it was not barred by collateral estoppel, that it survived, and focusing on limitations for a moment, why shouldn't we treat this the same way as we've treated legal malpractice, for example? Wasn't Kenneco placed in a position of having to argue on the one hand that there was no coverage and therefore its agent was negligent, at the same time it was arguing that there was coverage in the suit against the underwriters? Doesn't that put them in the same kind of box that we said lawyers shouldn't be or plaintiffs being lawyers shouldn't be placed in?
Well, I think this court certainly has never created some kind of discovery rule with regard to this kind of situation in which an insured is asserting a claim against the insurance agent. As a matter of fact, I think the Murray versus San Jacinto agency case, which holds very squarely in the context of a claim by an insured against the insurance carrier, that cause of action accrues when coverage is denied. And I think it's fairly clear on this record that Kenneco's cause of action for negligence against Johnson & Higgins accrued when coverage was denied in March of 1983, and that claim then became time-barred in March of 1985.
But although Kenneco contended that there was coverage and had to litigate that against the underwriter, are you saying it should have proceeded under two theories simultaneously? Number one, there was coverage, and sued the underwriters, and also sued Kenneco saying there was no coverage, and therefore Kenneco was negligent.
Well, Kenneco proceeded in the federal trial under two theories. One was that there was coverage under the policy. The alternative theory was that even if there was not coverage under the policy, representations had been made by Johnson and Higgins that bound the underwriters. And so Kenneco did proceed on both theories in the federal trial.
But it did not proceed on the theory that its agent was negligent in failing to procure adequate insurance.
It did not state a cause of action for negligence, but it did take the factual position that its agent had misrepresented what the policy would and would not cover. That Ms. Brown's testimony was to that effect. Mr. Anderson was called and contradicted that testimony. But that issue was tried, that factual issue that underlies the negligence finding in this case was tried in the federal court.
Could there still be a finding that there was no misrepresentation, but that there was a negligent failure to procure in this case? Could the jury have found that from the evidence in the second trial?
The jury question 21, was, did Johnson & Higgins fail to exercise ordinary care at the November 30, 1982 meeting? And the only evidence with regard to what happened at the November 30, 1982 meeting related to what Anderson said to Brown concerning whether or not there was coverage under the policy. So I think that the factual basis for the jury's answer to question number 21 went directly to the very misrepresentations that they alleged in this case Anderson had made, which the federal court found he had not made.
What would be inaccurate about the claim that the federal lawsuit dealt solely with the issue about whether or not there was contractual coverage here, and that the Texas lawsuit did not deal with the contractual issue but dealt with Article 2121 claims like that?
That overlooks the fact that in the federal lawsuit, Kenneco had alternative theories. And that's evident from Judge Grease's opinion. Kenneco's primary theory was that there was coverage under the insurance policy. Judge Grease had dealt with that, read the policy, found there was no coverage under the insurance policy. He then turned to the alternative argument which was that even though there was not coverage under the policy itself, statements or representations made by Johnson & Higgins created coverage which would not otherwise have existed. And it was that portion of the opinion in which he made the findings that he made concerning the November 30, 1982 meeting and dealt with the very same evidence, Brown's testimony and Anderson's testimony, that Kenneco relied upon in the state court trial here.
But did those comments and representations that were dealt with in the federal lawsuit point towards coverage under a different contract than the type of coverage which is being discussed here in the Texas case?
No. The specific findings that Judge Griesa made in the federal case were on page 1059 to 60. Brown said nothing which apprised Anderson that Armada wished to have coverage that would depart from the normal marine insurance and would cover possible loss of contract. Page 1061. There is nothing in Anderson's testimony to indicate that he was agreeing to insure against the loss of the Sun contract or profits under that contract. Page 1060. Anderson's deposition and a letter he wrote to Willis Faber on January 3 provides a more definitive account of the meeting than does Brown's testimony. The simple fact is that the evidence that Judge Griesa heard was the same evidence concerning the November 30 meeting that was presented in this case, and Judge Griesa believed Anderson and did not believe Brown. And it is for that reason that we ought not to be here, and should not have been in Houston relitigating facts that had already been found by a federal judge.
Can you move to the prejudgment interest?
I will do that. We, of course, are hopeful that the court will not reach the prejudgment interest point. But if indeed the court does affirm on one of the liability grounds, this is the case in which the court should address the bewildering confusion that exists in this state concerning prejudgment interest and restore once again the equity and symmetry in prejudgment interest law that it provided initially when it decided the Kavanaugh decision 11 years ago. Johnson and Higgins' position is that in all cases, commercial as well as personal injury, the standards for accrual date and compounding should be those established by the legislature in 1987 in Section 6 of Article 5069-1.05, rather than those standards that were devised by this court 2 years earlier in Kavanaugh. This court can reach that result in one of two ways. First, the court can, and we believe should, hold that Section 6, as a matter of statutory construction, applies to commercial cases as well as personal injury cases. Ms. Cortell was correct in the letter that she wrote to the court yesterday, as we have admitted in our brief, that most courts of appeals have concluded that the scope of Section 6 is limited to wrongful death, personal injury, and property damage cases. This court, however, should not make decisions based upon polling the courts of appeals. And we believe that as a matter of construction of the statutory language and review of the legislative history, and we have set out that analysis on pages 34 to 40 of our brief, that the construction engaged in by courts of appeals is incorrect, and that the statute should be read to apply to all judgments in all kinds of cases. More importantly, though, if the court concludes, as a matter of statutory construction, that Section 6 does not by its terms apply to commercial cases, the court should take this opportunity to update the standards of Kavanaugh and defer to the legislature's expressions of public policy concerning accrual date and compounding in much the same way that it did in its opinion last week in Concord versus Pennzoil, in which it looked to the legislature's policy expressions in the Natural Resources Code. When this court decided Kavanaugh, there were very few legislative expressions of public policy in the area of interest on judgments. The legislature had at that time, in Section 2 of Article 5069-1.05, decided what the rate of judgment, or what the rate of interest on judgments should be. And the court in Kavanaugh appropriately looked to that expression of public policy in determining the prejudgment interest rate. Now, though, 11 years later, there exists a detailed legislative scheme, including guidelines for accrual date and compounding, to which the court should look for guidance and which the court should adopt to the extent necessary in order to restore equity and symmetry to prejudgment interest law.
When the legislature enacted this statutory provision, they were aware of the existence of Kavanaugh.
Yes.
Why should we not presume that since they put those three items in the statutory provision, that they didn't intend to go ahead and have Kavanaugh apply to all other categories of claims?
I think a review of the legislative history will reveal that what the legislature basically did was work a compromise between those of its members who were supporting Kavanaugh and those of its members who wanted to abolish prejudgment interest altogether. And that's really the basis for our argument that the statute should be construed by this court to cover all kinds of cases. But
well,
even if the department...
It seems to me that argument supports the other side, and that is there was legislative compromise. The compromise was that they would include these three claims and leave everything else for Kavanaugh.
I think that imputes to the legislature an illogical motive or conclusion in which this court should not engage, because the current state of the law in this area is unacceptable. The standards for accrual date and compounding that this court fashioned in Kavanaugh to apply in the personal injury cases now apply only in commercial cases. And I see I'm now out of time.
But not extra. Is it your position that the first sentence in Section 6 is nothing more than an admonition to trial courts to be sure to include prejudgment interest in those three kind of cases, and all the rest of it applies to Section 2, all judgments?
That's
and therefore, we're going to use the rest of those subsections on all judgments.
That's my first position. My second and alternative position is that if that does limit the scope of the statute, then the court, with regard to what now becomes common law, prejudgment interest in the commercial context, should look to those portions of the statute for guidance in developing the appropriate common law standards.
Section 2.
Well, no.
Section 2 is the only other section that you can get to because it excludes contract cases, which clearly has its own criteria for determining interest. And if you take your interpretation, the first sentence of Section 6 is just to say, now, y'all be sure and do this in these three cases, but the rest of it applies to Section 2, all judgments, so that you have interest compounded annually at the rate of 10% or whatever the commissioner. Is that your argument?
My argument is that all of Section 6, or at least those portions of Section 6 dealing with the accrual date, and the compounding question, and Section 6 says no compounding but rather simple interest, that all of those provisions should apply to commercial cases just as they apply to personal injury cases, for the reason that there's no logical reason for making a distinction, and that the court can reach that conclusion either by concluding that the legislature did that or by exercising its power to update and modify its own Kavanaugh decision to make sure that Kavanaugh, as currently interpreted in the commercial area, is consistent with the legislature's expressions of policy in the personal injury area.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. The
court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Fonda.
May I please the court? Ms.
Nunez
has compelled argument.
Your Honor, before I start my formal remarks, I will tell you that I had a little car accident on the way to court this morning. I was in a cab, and we were about a block from here, and we rear-ended somebody, but I was very glad that none of you all got out of the car ahead of us. So I'm pleased to be here. Let me say, unequivocally, this is the first case in which Kenneco has had an opportunity to litigate its broker misconduct claims. The questions that were put to Mr. Tipps were right on. We did not have that opportunity, and we did not make those claims in the first lawsuit. And there is no way to get from the minuscule findings in the first lawsuit to a collateral estoppel bar in the second lawsuit. And that's the reason I prepared this chart. As the court may know, I'm a little bit new to this case. I came in after the briefing was submitted. But when I went through it and first read the petitioner's argument that we were barred because the prior court had found misrepresentation, I did become concerned. That is, until I read the federal court ruling. There is nothing in the federal court opinion on that there were or were not misrepresentations, whether Johnson Higgins engaged in deceptive conduct, on any of these findings. I very much disagree, respectfully disagree with Mr. Tips on what he has advised the court, and I simply would ask this court to please read the federal court finding, and you will not find those claims adjudicated, and you will not find those findings.
What about the statements like Brown did not testify in words or substance that Anderson ever agreed to such a thing?
Okay, well, first of all, let me draw a distinction, if you would, when you're reading the federal court opinion, between when they make true findings, what I say, when they get the evidence and they say the evidence showed X, and an observation by the federal judge that there was no testimony of Y. Why, I ask you to think, would it be that the court would observe there was no testimony of something? There's no testimony because the claim wasn't tried. The key witness from Johnson and Higgins did not appear live at the trial in New York. That's James Anderson. He appeared only by deposition. And he was alive with us. In response to what Justice Owens raised earlier, we were walking arm in arm together to the federal court, taking what position? That we had coverage. That
and
is
if you're going to try to win on the other claim, the claim that the agent bound the underwriter.
Right.
Don't you have to prove that J&H was Kenneco's agent and that they made these representations? And that's the only way you can tag the underwriter.
Well, we're saying that they correctly, the issue in New York was whether there was coverage and whether we were told there was coverage by Kenneco, excuse me, by Johnson Higgins, by the broker.
Right.
And to that extent, the meeting of November 30 was litigated in New York. And if this court were to look at just whether a transaction were litigated, that might be one matter. But that's not the standard in collateral estoppel. Okay?
But if Johnson and Higgins had gotten up on the stand in the federal lawsuit and said, yes, we represent the underwriters, and yes, we made this promise and it ought to bind them, that would have been pretty tough.
And I would say to Your Honor that to the extent there's a finding on that issue, it goes to this one piece. One thing that gets terribly confused in the briefing is that there were two agreements, or two coverages. And the finding in the federal court on whether or not there was an agreement binding the underwriters, and I want you to think about the entirety of the federal court finding, is there an agreement binding the London underwriters with a different interpretation? That's as close as we get. And of course, that's an alternative finding, and I want to talk about that for a minute. But it's an alternative finding on only one 23 questions that went to the jury in this case. And you simply cannot take a single finding, even an alternative finding to do, and somehow extrapolate that into a bar against an entire lawsuit that was never tried. We couldn't go into New York and allege they were negligent. We couldn't go in and say they lied to us. We wouldn't shoot ourselves in the foot. There is no doctrine in Texas that we're required bring all alternative theories against all parties that might be involved in transactions, particularly where it's here, they're inconsistent.
Well, but
it would
if
have
you
been
wanted
suicide
to,
in New York.
But it, to bind the underwriters.
Right.
On the theory that maybe there's not coverage under the policy, but they promised it to us anyway. You have to prove agency and representation or agreement.
No question. And we have findings that we have to deal with. But my main point to Your Honor that I do not think is clear from the briefing is that at most that goes to question 13. And we did not litigate misconduct. And the finding of no agreement doesn't even talk about contingency coverage. The federal court does not make those findings on contingency coverage.
But if the agent says, if the court finds that the agent did not agree to any further coverage and didn't misrepresent that he was getting it, isn't that the end of this case?
I really don't think so, Your Honor, because, and indeed, one of the odd parts about what happened in the federal court was they couldn't understand, let me go a little bit further. They went ahead and concluded that there was misconduct by Johnson and Higgins, And, of course, we can't use that finding against them because they weren't parties, so we're kind of stuck in that catch-22 of collateral estoppel. But we went ahead and we relitigated in Houston. And I think one of the interesting things about the trial is they read these federal court findings to the jury. The jury had the benefit of hearing what Judge Griesel had to say and rejected it. And rejected it why? Because for the first time, they had the full opportunity to hear all of the witnesses' testimony, fact witness as well as expert witness testimony on what happened at that November 30 meeting. And they found that the broker did not fulfill its obligations to us. The relationship at issue in New York was whether Johnson Higgins could bind the underwriters, not whether Johnson and Higgins screwed up with regard to us. That simply wasn't there, and it would be unfair for this court to adopt a theory that would require the insured to bring conflicting theories in the first case to avoid suing later on, particularly whereas here you have in question 10 a finding that they induced us not to sue them. Because from 1982 forward, well, let me back up, you've got two frauds in this case. You've got the fraud at the meeting on November 30, 1982, and you have a continuing fraud thereafter, because what happened? Did they ever say to us, oh, we screwed up, you don't have coverage?
Well, but that's not a good argument. If you got the fraud on November 30th, that's the day that your cause of action starts to accrue, doesn't it? You might have a claim for fraudulent concealment of their fraudulent statements, which would get the limitations told, but to say that it's a continuing fraud.
Well, we have a finding. We have a finding that takes us up to the point of a standstill agreement.
Fraud has a four-year statute. What about the two-year statute on DTPA and negligence claims? Where are you on that?
We have an insurance claim that's pre-1985, and the cases say that that's a four-year statute of limitation. It is undisputed
under the insurance code.
Under the insurance code.
I'm talking about negligence and DTPA.
Okay. Well, let me back up and make a couple comments on limitations.
First, would you agree negligence has a two-year statute?
Negligence is 2 years.
DTPA is two years.
2 years. But our position is that we submitted an insurance code claim, and so that's what the Court of Appeals found, and I think the record supports it. That would be 4 years. And there's no point of error on whether our claims are untimely for breach of contract or fraud. So there's no dispute on appeal that if we can succeed on breach of contract or fraud, that our claims are timely. On the insurance code, we refer you to the cases both that the Court of Appeals relied on that are in our briefing, but the four-year statute applies, and again, like fraud
were the breach damages, of contract. What were the damages awarded on what claims? All four of them?
The damages varied, Your Honor. In question six, they were $1.5 million. Insurance code is about $1 million when it's trebled. Agreement to secure lost profits is 1.5. Agreement to secure contingency coverage is 412,000, and negligence is 1.7. The Court of Appeals gave us recovery under breach of contract because that was our greatest recovery. Now, if I could say two things on the cases. One, I really would urge this court to look at this case in terms of Cisco versus Trapnell, which of course is a 94 decision, always memorable for the facts of that case because it's that horrid deal where a poor woman went through the food line and got that food substance and then died shortly thereafter. I always remember it for the facts and not the law. I still go through food lines. What I would say to you on that case is, what did this court do? One, you said we have to look narrowly at the finding. You refused to say that it was a causation finding that was preclusive. You looked specifically to the finding that food whitener was not added. I would say the same thing in this case. You have a very narrow finding. Ultimately, in Cisco, you did not apply the collateral estoppel doctrine because it didn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in this case because you do not have findings on the other issues. You're still going to have claims that have to be tried. And you cannot take the minor findings that do exist and extrapolate them into a bar against the entire suit. You simply can't do it.
Ms. Cordell, let me ask you on that point. For Hanico to have a claim against Johnson Higgins, it has to, doesn't it, establish that it made a request for this coverage?
Right.
And in the federal case, wasn't it an essential issue there that Kenneco had made a request to this agent for this coverage?
There is no question with the transaction that the meeting at issue was talked about in New York. But if I could, in thinking it through last night, which I guess is always when your best thinking goes on for these things, When this court decided Barr versus RTC, which was a bank transaction on a note, and you said, well, you sue a guy on a note, you can't turn around in a second lawsuit and sue him on a guarantee arising out of the same transaction. When you have your opponent in front of you, you must sue him on all claims arising out of that transaction. We did not have Johnson & Higgins in front of us in New York, so there was no incentive, no notice that we had to try all of our claims against them. So whether or not the transaction was at issue.
But my question is, in the New York suit, Kenneco had to establish, if the contract itself didn't cover it, then Kenneco at least had to establish that it made the request for coverage to an agent. It made a request for coverage. Isn't that a critical piece of evidence in the federal lawsuit up in New York with Kenneco on the alternative theory?
I'm not sure it was essential to any judgment up there, and I'm not even sure it's essential to this judgment, because what happened was...
There was no coverage.
What the court finds in New York is a contract construction case, and the primary holding in New York is, after looking at the primary policy, they find that there was no coverage. Our position is that at the infamous meeting of November 30th, we talk to this guy, we tell him what he wants, what we want, he tells us we have it, he charges us for one of the coverages, he keeps the premium, he documents it with two declarations, and what we're saying to the jury in Houston is, look, we all thought there was coverage, but if there isn't, this guy screwed up, because he told us we had coverage, and then fills out documentary evidence to that effect and charges us for it. That is misconduct. And those claims, Your Honor, with all due deference, were not tried in New York.
I'm not arguing that any of those claims were tried at all. The fact of the request for the coverage was necessary in the federal lawsuit to have a recovery under the implied authority to bind the underwriters, isn't it? Isn't that necessary to get under the alternative theory in New York that this agent had the authority to bind the underwriters? Wouldn't that be a critical element? We made the request to this agent.
I believe we put evidence on that we made that request to New York.
Now,
but I don't know that it's essential
for the trial court to say there was no recovery under that theory. The court could decide that the agent didn't have the authority to bind it. Or the court could decide that no representation was made. No request was made for the coverage. Then how come that fact is not binding on Kenneco coming to Texas to argue all these other claims that all begin with exactly the same fact? We made a request for coverage.
I'm not sure I quite agree with your hypothetical, but let's say you are right. And let's say we have to prove a request. It's not essential to the judgment in New York. It's not even essential to what we were talking about here. And at best, if it is essential, it again only goes to question 13. It doesn't go to whether there was broker misconduct. And Your Honor, I think the proof is in the pudding. I'd like to direct you to their request for declaratory relief. It's transcript page 350. They did not request in this petition that all claims be barred, because they knew better. They knew better. That's really their res judicata argument. Their collateral estoppel argument on page 350 is they want relief. They want a declaration the defendant is collaterally stopped from asserting that the plaintiff made any type of enforceable agreement to obtain insurance coverages which were not enforced concerning the cargo. Okay? They're being more truthful with you there, if I may say. They're saying, if anything, this bars you on agreement. And I'm going to go one step further, Your Honor. There were two agreement findings, and their request is wrong insofar as they pretend it goes to contingency coverage. The finding of federal court, at best, goes to this, and it doesn't go to this for two reasons. One, I don't think it does relate. It's an agreement as to whether it bound the London underwriters, not as to whether they had an agreement with us, because there were other ways they could get us insurance other than binding the London underwriters. But secondly, I want to talk about Eagle Properties. I had had some involvement in Eagle Properties. It involved the First National Bank of Midland efforts by makers of a note to get out of that note. They sued First National Bank, or rather, I guess what happened is RTC or FDIC, one of them, took over the bank, sue on the note, and there's intense litigation in federal court as to whether the bank can enforce the note to avoid the fraud claim. The primary holding in the federal court is that the FDIC is, in essence, a holder in due course, and therefore can avoid the defense. The alternative finding that this court focused on in its Eagle Properties case was, of course, that there was no fraud in the inducement. The main point I want to make to you about Eagle Properties is it's an apple-apple situation. Fraud in the inducement was fully litigated in the federal court. What happened in the case before this court is that the makers of the note sought to relitigate the same fraud in the inducement claim, albeit with a different defendant, okay? They were now suing the directors of the bank instead of the bank. But it's apple-apple. Fraud in the inducement, fraud in the inducement. You do not have apple-apple here. You have apple-orange, okay? Fraud in the inducement or deceptive conduct or negligence was not litigated in the federal court. Only coverage.
He said that you did, they billed you for two different kinds of coverage. That you actually had coverage for some contingencies, it just wasn't the contingencies that actually occurred. Is that correct?
That's what ultimately the federal court said.
So they didn't bill you for something that...
We went in and told them exactly what we wanted. And they gummed it up, and I could...
But they did give you coverage. They didn't bill you for coverage that was never provided.
They did bill us. And the federal court found it was wrong that they billed us.
Wrong that they billed you
for the contingency coverage that they could not provide. The whole purpose of the contingency coverage was so that we wouldn't have to chase the Brazilians in New York. It turned out there was no contingency coverage, that it couldn't be provided because it's kind of complicated. It goes into whether it was back-to-back CIF. Our position is they had to know at the November 30 meeting it was not back-to-back CIF, mostly because...
But the court in New York found differently. They said you did not tell them when they did it, it was not back-to-back CIF. They affirmatively...
And I've read that opinion a lot. If you go back through, what you'll find a lot of times what the federal court is saying is there was no testimony of X. They're not saying the testimony showed Y. So I'm not sure that was fully litigated. But the point is that when a jury in Houston, Texas heard all of the witnesses' testimony and also had the benefit of federal court findings, believed Carolyn Brown when she said, no, I made it clear to him. And let me also explain to you why the jury understood that, because if it had been back-to-back CIF, there would have been no November 30, 1982 meeting. And this is real complicated, and I hate to get into all this detail. But if it had been back-to-back CIF, take my word for it, we would have not had risk of loss. There would have been no reason to meet with our broker and get lost profits coverage. It wouldn't have been our problem, because title would have passed in Rio de Janeiro, and that's what the jury understood. And the fact of the matter is that Johnson Higgins did not understand that. I mean, there was confusion. They write it up. They tell us we have it. And again, I would say to you that we went in for two coverages. He writes it up, he charges us, we walk away thinking we have both, and learn from the New York litigation, spending $750,000 in New York to litigate it, after which we learned that we have the coverage we were promised. We were entitled to litigate those misconduct claims, and the jury vindicated our claims.
Ms. Cortell, let me ask you a question about the interest.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope we didn't get to that.
In light of the policy of in-style legislature, and the new statutory scheme, why should we not reconsider the Supreme Court's opinion?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor. If I could also back up and say, I think your answer presupposes, and I would agree, if it is presupposing, but I don't want to assume too much, that the statute does not by its own terms apply. It cannot. If I could just give a few reasons for that, then I'll go to the policy question. Is that all right?
Yes.
It cannot apply by its own terms, first of all, because if you look at the first line, very clearly it only talks about the three enumerated causes of action. And I ask you to compare that to Section 2 of 105, which talks about all judgments. Also, the reading that's urged upon you by Johnson Higgins is inconsistent with Section 7 of 105. Section 7 provides for prejudgment interest in condemnation cases. If Section 6 applied across the board, then why would you have Section 7 that speaks about prejudgment interest and condemnation? And also the reading that they're talking about conflicts with 103, which provides another prejudgment interest rule. I also disagree with their reading of legislative history, as I think, Justice Abbott, you were picking up with on your questions. And therefore, I think it's no surprise that the overwhelming majority of courts have rejected what they've said. I just don't think you can get from here to there. The harder question, I do agree, is should this court reassess Kavanaugh? Kavanaugh, obviously, in 1985, was a new day for prejudgment interest, no question about it. The goals, though, articulated by the court were significant, and this court has reiterated those goals time and again. And, of course, the goals primarily are full compensation to the plaintiff for his injury, expediting settlement without providing incentive for delay. After Kavanaugh, this court reiterated the importance of the Kavanaugh goals in Matthews v. DeSoto, 1986, Perry Ruthing, 1988, Rio Grande v. Light, 1988, and as recently as last year in Owens, Illinois. In Owens, Illinois, this court reiterated the goals of Kavanaugh and did not walk away from them. Admittedly, the court did not apply a bright line application of the rule, and the issue, of course, the primary issue is what is your accrual date? In Kavanaugh, this court said, it is so important to compensate the plaintiff for his injury. If all damages have accrued by the date of entry, we'll look at the date of entry. If they've accrued over time, we'll look at 6 months after that date. If this court goes with the statutory written notice accrual date, you will be abandoning the goal of full compensation to the plaintiff. I cannot think of any reason why this court wants to walk from that goal. I would say I find of interest that the Owens, Illinois case shows some flexibility, that if the date of injury rule really works an injustice, as this court perceived it did in Owens, Illinois, this court has the freedom to walk away from the date of injury.
Well, let me ask you this. In light of the fact that the interest rate that in the way that it would be calculated under Kavanaugh would provide a rate of interest in excess to the litigant of what they could achieve in the market other than something that has high risk and be somewhat speculative, how can you argue that that comports with the concept of not overcompensating the parties? Why does it not overcompensate the parties?
Well, first of all, of course, I'm assuming you're not backing off of the 10% because that's based on a T-bill rate in Section 2, and this
right.
court, I think, will stay with that. I think the harder issue, should the court go with simple interest, compounded daily, or compounded annually? Obviously, after this court decided Kavanaugh in 85, there was an amendment in 87 in Section 2 to which Kavanaugh refers, and it went to compounded annually. So I can understand that. Simple interest obviously starts to cut into it quite a bit, and I think to answer your question most directly, and let me back up, and I know I'm way over my time now. When one says what does or does not approximate market return, there's any number of things you can look to. And obviously the amicus brief before this court, I think, looked to CDs or some fairly low return. If you were to flip that and if you were going to look at someone investing money in the market and seeing what kind of return you can get in the stock market, then Kavanaugh is low. It's lower than that type of return would be. My client happens to be here today, Your Honor, and he's done a study from Standard & Poor's, and I don't know if that would be useful to provide the court, but we could. We were well below what market return would be. And I will remind Your Honor of what this court said in Matthews v. DeSoto. I believe it was that case where this court recognized that it's folly to think that a plaintiff would prefer to wait to delay judgment day so that they can get this great return on prejudgment interest. That's just not so. It's always going to be in the plaintiff's interest to get the recovery as soon as possible and to do as much as they can with that money. I mean, you're going to get a better return.
Any other questions?
I think I've overstayed my welcome. Sorry.
Thank you, Kim.
Let me begin, if I may, by touching very briefly on two things about Kenneco's chart on the left side that are simply wrong. First, question number 10 was not an equitable estoppel issue. Question number 10 was submitted pursuant to Section 17.56A of the DTPA, tracked the language of that statute. More importantly, it was predicated on an affirmative answer to question 8, which is the DTPA producing cause finding. Kenneco seeks to use the finding in answer to question 10 to stop Johnson Higgins' limitations defense to the negligence claim. But the inappropriateness of that is evident from the fact that if the jury had not answered the DTPA issue the way Kenneco wanted it to, it would never even have reached question 10. Second, the second set of issues is not properly viewed as an insurance code set of issues. It should be viewed as a DTPA set of issues. Those issues were submitted by Judge McCorkle pursuant to the DTPA. Perhaps the best evidence of that is the fact that Judge McCorkle submitted question 10, which tracks Section 17.56A of the DTPA. That's the suspension provision that allows the extra 180 days. There was, at that time this cause of action accrued, no similar provision under the insurance code. And so the only reason for submitting question 10 would have been because the case was submitted pursuant to the DTPA.
Is it true that you don't even complain about a judgment under fraud and breach of contract? That there's no point of error on limitations as to those grounds?
There is no limitations bar on fraud or breach of contract because there was a tolling agreement entered. Let me now move to the let me stay here on the left side for just a second. Issues 1, 7, 13, 17, and 21, every one of them inquires about conduct that occurred either at the November 30, 1982 meeting or conduct that occurred on or about November 30, 1982. Judge Grisa made extensive findings concerning what happened at that meeting. The argument that Kenneco is making is that the specific state court issues listed on the left-hand side, common law negligence, DTPA violations, were not tried in New York. Of course they were not tried in New York. There was no cause of action in New York under the DTPA. Collateral estoppel applies, though, because the factual predicate for the findings made by Judge Grisa is the same as the factual predicate for issues 1, 7, 13, 17, and 21. The Court of Appeals in this very case...
Before you proceed, how about the argument that the parties were different?
The parties were different, but under collateral estoppel, it is only required that the party against whom collateral estoppel is being asserted have been a party, and Kenneco was a party. And so that element of collateral estoppel has been satisfied, even according to the Court of Appeals.
Should a distinction be drawn between findings and statements that there is no evidence, either way?
I think they're all findings. Yeah. Judge Grisa stated his conclusory findings under his summary of rulings on page 1051, but in his extensive recitation concerning the events of the November 30, 1982 meeting, I think for purposes of collateral estoppel, that properly should be considered to be factual findings. And the fact is that Judge Grisa's findings relate not only to question 13, but they relate also to 1, 7, 17, and 21. All of those issues, factually, related to whether or not Anderson represented or agreed in his conversation with Brown that there was coverage on the Sun contract beyond the contract. The only place where it's different has to do with question 17, which is relates to contingency coverage. And on that question, as Judge Owen pointed out, Judge Grisa found that Ms. Brown made no statements with regard to whether the contract was back-to-back CIF. Anderson indicated that it was his understanding that it was, and the court believed Anderson's testimony.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the foregoing comments, and they all will be submitted to the court on briefs and oral arguments. Marshall will adjourn the court.
All rise.